thank you for tuning in. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, and as always, it's good to have you here. We have another interesting program for you lined up today. As we continue our investigations, we are back in the trenches, the warfare of our time, which is, in my opinion, truth versus lies, the only two sides that really exist. We are going to continue to examine one of those portions of history where we probably have the most amount of lies surrounding, and of course a tremendous amount of cover-up as well. In order to justify the horrors of any war, a period in history where so many people, you know, fall short, they fall off the horse completely before they even begin to examine it. But it's easy to miss the elephant in the room due to the carpet bombing of lies that the so-called historians, academics, and officials have laid out for us. But as I hope you know by now, there is a lot more to the story of the Second World War than we are being led to believe. Today we're going to look at the horrors of what was done to the German people and look at their own accounts and writings. This is a program not for the faint of heart. It's brutal, horrific, inhumane, ultimately unbelievably disturbing to realize what we'll be talking about here today. But this is what was done to the German people, and for over 70 years, people have continued to justify it and looked the other way. Due to the lies that they've been told in regards to what the German people was about and what they tried to achieve, these are indeed murderous lies. So today we'll be talking with author Tom Goodridge about this difficult topic. Tom was raised in Kansas and Missouri. Before he began writing books, he was painting watercolors for a living in New England. He graduated from Washburn University. Before he majored in history, he majored in psychology. He is the author of Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 1947. In addition to this, he's written about the American Civil War, the Indian Wars, and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. He's also written about the rock apes of Gibraltar, the tiny nation state of Andorra, the Pied Piper of Hamelin Town, and the pitfalls of living in primitive countries. Tom is outspoken, not shy to voice his opinions in terms of where his work has led him. This is a heavy topic ahead here, but I hope you appreciate this hidden and neglected part of our history. So thank you for making an effort and for the appreciation for exposing these lies in our history. Hey, Tom, welcome to Red Ice Radio. It's great to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on. It's a pleasure speaking with you. I hope you're doing well today.
I'm doing very well, Henry. Thanks so much for having me.
Excellent. There's going to be a lot of. Well, I guess I can't say fun because it's not a fun topic, but it's an important topic and a really, really, you know, one that we need to discuss and one that we've been trying to get closer to on the radio show in the last few months, really, from this kind of point of view and from this angle. I have always felt very daunted approaching World War II because it's just such an immense, immense topic. There's so many intricacies. There's so many things that have occurred. It's almost like even to this day, there are not only, you know, debates, of course, of what happened or whatnot, but even people studying, you know, small campaigns, intricacies of what actually occurred in that year in this region. It was just such a shock event, I think, overall, that we're still kind of grappling to make terms with what actually occurred. But what I really like about your work is that you've detailed this from the point of view of those who lost World War II. That's one of the most important things that we need to bring. I think you mentioned this elsewhere, Tom, that if we want to get the other story to this side, if we want to get the Allies' version of this, all we have to do is turn on the TV or even go to the library and pick up a book because it's all, you know, full of that. But we'll get into this as we go here, Tom. But tell us first your entry into this topic and why you wanted to write your book, Hellstorm.
Well, I was born in the element, of course. The 50s, the 60s, the veterans of World War II were everywhere. My dad, well, actually both of my fathers, my biological father, who was a Marine fighting against the Japanese in the Pacific War, and my adopted father, who was in the European Theater of Operations, the ETO, as they say. Both of them were veterans of World War II, and so I lived with that. It was on TV in America. There was just almost a nonstop parade of war movies, even in the 50s and 60s, glorifying the glorious crusade in Europe, the good war, the greatest generation, the victorious side. And I think that's as succinctly as I can put it, Henrik, is that it was and remains very close to me. But let me go a little further on this. I've been writing for roughly 30 years now, and some of my early books were on the American Civil War, or on the American Indian Wars, or on Abraham Lincoln and his assassination. I have always had a nose for controversy. When I've realized that there is a certain facet of American history or world history that has not been adequately covered, that has been covered up, let's say, then my nose, that's where I go. I seem to have been born with a gene that snoops out controversy. When someone's hiding something, I like to find it and reveal it. And all of my books, in a smaller sense, have been that. They have been, the word now in coinage is revisionist. I don't like that term. I think it's just a fresh look at old history, personally. And World War II, of all world history, nothing needs a fresh look more. No event in world history needs to be reexamined more than World War II history. My book, alas, unfortunately, is the only book in 70-some years to actually deal with what the war looked like from the loser's perspective in total. Now, there have been various books and various good books that have tried to allow us to understand what it did look like among the rubble, to be a defeated nation in the world's worst war, the world's most devastating war. But no other book has ever tried to bring it all together in the totality of this monstrous, horrible debacle that Europe suffered during World War II. This was not a good war. It was not a good war for anyone except perhaps the Jewish leadership in the world today. It was not a good war for Europe. Let me tell you that. It was not a good war for England or America. Look at what we've got today.
Yeah.
And these certainly, I don't know about Sweden, but I know Sweden was neutral, but in America now they have a coinage term called the greatest generation, meaning the Americans who went over and destroyed Nazi Germany were the greatest generation. Of course, it was coined by Jews who in America, they try to put a happy face on a really terrible war. But anyway, the book itself talks about the crimes committed against Germany. And Henrik, I like to call this, you made a comment in the introduction, a very nice introduction, by the way, that you don't want to say you enjoyed reading the book. No, it's the only book I've ever had that when I've handed it over to someone, I've never said, I hope you enjoy the book. This is not the kind of book you can enjoy.
Nope.
I should say I haven't, but I should say I hope this book outrages you, makes you angry. First makes you sad, but then makes you angry and makes you vow that you will never, ever, ever allow something like this to happen in your lifetime again. You will work that day and night and fight to prevent something like this from happening again. But the book... The darkest and best kept secret in world history, excuse me. That's the way I like to title this book, or The Powerful Price of Propaganda. How Germany suddenly decided in the 1930s after Adolf Hitler's election to presidency that they were going to stand on their own two feet. They were not going to be taking orders from anybody, especially the pack of wolves at Versailles that tried to bring Germany down and keep her down. When Adolf Hitler took control of Germany, elected to the presidency, basically it was Germany standing up and saying, yeah, that's enough. We're on our own now. We will do it our way. We're tired of being bossed around by the bankers and the allies who had defeated them in World War I. And, of course, Hitler's Mein Kampf said very vividly what he planned to do once he was elected to the chancellorship. He was going to rid Germany of all Jewish influence. Now, he didn't say he was going to kill Jews. He didn't say he was going to even throw them out. He's basically going to make Germany German again. Mm-hmm. In other words, in the arts, in the academia, in government, in politics, in law, in medicine, many of the positions had been taken over, usurped by Jews. And it's the same way in Europe today as America as it was then in Germany. But Hitler was good to his word. And I should say this. I should preface what I'm saying right now with this caveat. I am not an expert on world history. I am not an expert on European history. I am not an expert on Weimar Republic history of Germany. I am an expert on this book, Hellstorm. And so when I speak out of hand about history of anything but the book, I'm basically on thin ice, so to speak. I basically am shooting from the hip. This is what I think and what I know and what I've found in my research, but I'm not an expert. I am an expert on this book. So there are listeners out there right now who know more about the Treaty of Versailles or right. the Weimar Republic than I'll ever know. And so please bear with me as I try to develop this story. But I should say this, that there have been a number of books, a number of good books, too, that have revealed various aspects of this terrific crime committed against Germany from 1944 to 1947. They cover various aspects. For instance, David Irving's wonderful book on the destruction of Dresden. It was a wonderful, a good revealing read. There are other books talking about the dissolution or the forced repatriation of the forced removal, rather, of Germans from their ancestral homelands in the eastern parts of Germany, as well as Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary, and other Central European nations. There have been a lot of individuals who have pointed out various aspects of this crime committed against Germany, but Hellstorm is the only book in 70 years that actually tries to bring it all together so we can understand just what the nation was facing. What was done in the name of democracy, in the name of freedom to Germany? And it's a crime so staggering, Henrik, that there is no word in the English language. Perhaps there is something in some other language, Swedish, Chinese, I'm not sure, that would describe this beastly, monstrous crime. Hellstorm is the closest word I can come to it.
Yeah.
Holocaust doesn't cut it. Genocide doesn't make it. Hellstorm is the only thing that even approaches it. Let me give you an example of what I mean, what the Germans had to endure, and some of the things that were kept silent that we know very little about. Allied terror bombing. I mentioned David Irving talking about that in his book on Dresden. And it's true. It was called terror bombing among the Germans. I think even some of the RAF British pilots and the Americans also knew it as terror bombing. They weren't kidding themselves. They knew what they were doing. They were slaughtering women and children down below in the German cities. This was sanctified. It was sanctioned by the British and American governments, this deliberate attempt to kill as many people as possible. Forget the military targeting. That was early in the war. This was later in the war, 1944 to 45. A deliberate attempt to scorch from the face of the earth every German city above a certain size, let's say 25,000 people. We've all heard of Dresden. If we haven't, we should have heard of Dresden.
Yeah.
But what most people don't know is that almost every German city suffered a similar fate. That is, a terrible, devastating bombing, and then a firestorm that's created by dropping phosphorus bombs to ignite the rubble that's blown this town to bits. And, of course, people die by the tens of thousands in these bombing raids. Dresden just happens to be the most reported upon. People like David Irving pointed out, curiously enough, today there's a real effort to try to diminish the terror bombing, the impact of the terror bombing. Some people say, well, Dresden was horrible. We agree, but there was only like 25 or 35,000 people died in Dresden. That's a lie, and they know that. When they're trying to diminish this, they're trying to diminish the impact of the crime. There was anywhere from, in my estimate, from 250,000 to 400,000. Now, this isn't me just guessing from Florida in the United States. I used the International Red Cross statistics, also statistics of people on the ground, Berlin reports when they sent people there to find out. There were people that were never found. Thousands of people were never, ever found. Of course, we know that for 2 weeks after the the raid on Dresden, they were still burying bodies and still burning bodies. They were still finding them. But, for instance, in this book, Hellstorm, let me give you an example. In the words of the people themselves, by the way, they talk about things like when a little boy and his dad went back to their business inside central Dresden to see if they could salvage something from the scorched remains. They went down into the basement, and it was dark, and they hit the last step and went down onto the floor, and they found themselves wading through something very thick, a very thick liquid, roughly 6 inches deep, up to their ankles. And what it was fat from humans that had burned above and dripped down into this cellar. That's why thousands were never found, because they were just simply burned up. And by the way, I should say also, I think it bears repeating, that this is not just me talking about the crimes committed against Germany in Hellstorm. This is the people themselves. It's a you are their approach. I try to let the people do the talking as much as possible, what it was like to endure an Allied terror bombing and hopefully survive, what it was like to be raped 100 times per week by the Americans or by the Soviets. In the words of the people themselves, Henrik, you can destroy the messenger, me, Thomas Goodrich, who wrote this book, but you cannot destroy the message. It's in the words of the people themselves. Yeah. And that's why I think this was so important to take this approach, is that people who might be critical of me, it's very hard to ignore the words of the victims themselves or the victimizers who actually perpetrated these crimes. But I mentioned the rape. A component in this book that runs throughout from beginning to end, and there's no way to get away from it because it was occurring in that period, 1944 to 1947, is rape. Rape, the spiritual massacre of German womanhood. Now, it was never sanctified, or it was never made legal in the U.S., Britain, or France, but it was in the Soviet Union. We know because Stalin's minister of propaganda, a Jew named Ilya Ehrenberg, actually dropped leaflets from airplanes that he had penned, that he had written, by the thousands and tens of thousands, and as they fluttered down on the Russian forces ready to invade Germany in the autumn of 1944. They were terrible, terrible commands from Ilya Ehrenberg for these rough Russian soldiers to go into Germany, and when they got there, they were to basically kill everything that moved. First and foremost, though, they were to have fun with the German women. They were to take them for their own, as Ilya Ehrenberg said, take them for your own, and when you're through with them, kill them. Nothing in Germany is guiltless, said Ehrenberg. Not those living, or not even those unborn. Take them as your lawful booty, and then kill them when you are through. And time again, he wrote the same things, and they were promoted throughout the Red Army. As you can imagine, young soldiers, 18 to 25, peasant boys from Belarus, Ukraine, White Russia, they acted upon these words because they...
Why do you think that is? I've been thinking about this too, and I was talking with Lana the other day about this and the immense atrocities that occurred on this level. And I mean, in some cases, we even have men raping other men, men raping children, men raping women. And I'm like, and gang rapes where several soldiers are raping one woman over and over again. I mean, can we just explain this by the fact that they were following, you know, higher up orders, or have they been, was this some kind of traumatization over all of what occurred due to the climate of what they've been going through that kind of made them so malleable and so robotic, for the lack of a better term, that they just did what they're told? I mean, because I can't even fathom in those kinds of conditions, who even would be able to perform something like that in front of all these other men and soldiers and whatnot. It's just horrendous. I don't understand it. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me try to briefly explain as it occurs in this book. We're talking about young boys, generally 16, 17, 18 to 25 years old, ill-educated, ignorant Russian peasant boys who have nothing back in their home. Let's assume that, first of all, let me say this. I was 18 at one time. I was also in the military. I also remember vividly some of my fellow soldiers, and they seem to lack soul. They seem to lack a conscience at that age. It's perhaps they have it, but it just hasn't fully developed. It comes later in life, it seems, 30 and 40, when you develop a conscience that allows you to actually think what you have done. 18 to 25, they mostly think with their penis. I learned. And unfortunately, there are many of these in every army I've ever studied. Now, that said, we're also talking about a very unsophisticated bunch of people, the Russians. Don't forget, they had been bled white for 40 years by Jewish Bolshevism. They had nothing, had virtually nothing.
And the best and the brightest were taken care of, died in the millions in the gulags, you know. Many of the people who were had a lot of capability and whatnot, they were taken out in Russia, you know.
Yes, and don't forget, by and large, the commissars in the Russian army were Jewish. Now, there was a lot of commissars, but these are the political officers that are in every unit above, I suppose, above a platoon, that are there to make sure that everyone toes the party line. Everyone's a good communist. Everyone's a good German hater. In other words, you've got these people, these Jewish commissars, badgering the soldiers to kill more, to kill more, kill more, rape more. And basically, they're the cheerleaders that go along with every unit, roughly the size of a company, I would say. And so you've got these unsophisticated soldier boys, youthful. You've got the Jewish commissars who are encouraging them to do their dead level best. And then you've got also some legitimate motives by themselves. In other words, let's just assume a Russian boy from Belarus has seen his village destroyed after the Germans came through, seen their cows shot down, or, you know, in other words, he's got some legitimate motives for revenge on his own. I'm not saying the Germans made a policy of this, but I'm saying you have to understand that. And so when someone like Ilya Ehrenberg, on the right hand of Joseph Stalin, says it is not only okay, but it's almost a command for you to take the German women, play with them, rape them as often as you want, and then kill them, that sounds like an order. That's sanctified. That's sanctioned by the Soviet government. And so it becomes almost, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, it was almost a combat distinction to rape.
Yeah.
So when you have a monster like this created, you're going to have millions of German women raped, and you're going to have millions of them killed, too. In fact, it's such a hideous crime. That crime alone is so enormous, so monstrous, so vicious, so depraved, so ugly, that to me, it's the worst aspect of this entire book, because it occurs with such frequency over and over. And it's not just the Russians that are doing it. It's also the Americans. As one American sergeant said, we were also an army of rapists. It was just covered up better on the American side. The propaganda mill was working much faster over there, whereas the Russians, it was right there for anyone to see. But they're – well – I just could not imagine. Well, for instance, people say, well, it's just rape. And the ones who survived, it's not so bad. It's just rape. It's just, hey, it's more than just rape. It's the spiritual massacre, the deliberate destruction of German womanhood by rape, by penis, a weapon. For instance, let's just say you're a mother, a head of a family, and Russians break into your home. And they viciously rape you on the living room table in front of your family. And your children see this, and they beg and they cry. And your husband sees this, but he's warned, if you do anything, we'll cut you in half. You see this saw we've got here? We will literally cut you in half. Well, okay, there's nothing happened. That woman goes through the rape and she survives. Well, how does she go on being a mother and a wife? Yeah. How does she stay in love with her husband who didn't lift a finger to protect her? Of course he was going to be killed. Well, how does she get along with her life? Of course she doesn't. Or if you're a school teacher in a village, and the Russians roll in, and you are forced to perform oral sex in front of your entire class for 30 filthy soldiers, and then you're raped repeatedly, and then the children have to watch. How do you go back once, if you survive, provided you survive, how do you go back to teaching school?
Yeah.
The next day, or the next week, the next year. How do you get back to normalcy? And let me also say this about rape. I found this out, and the people themselves say as much, that even though the frontline shock troops, that is the first wave of soldiers going through fighting the German front lines, these were the majority of them were white Russians. They were Belarus, Ukrainian, those type of guys. They were the best of the Soviet fighters. They mostly had way too many things on their mind to be stealing and burning and looting and raping, above all raping. They were more worried about surviving as they tripped door to door and kicked in doors to find out if there were any Germans fighting in there. Although they did their share of terrible atrocities, it was the rear echelon that we can lay most of the blame for this on. That is the rape, because the rear echelon, the second wave of troops that came through, the men that were driving the wagons or driving the trucks with supplies, were by and large Asiatics, the Mongolians, the Kulaks, the Kazakhstanis, people like that, because Russian officers would warn German families as they moved through. They say, you go quick. We hard-fighting soldiers, the next group to come, these are animals. We hate them too, ourselves. Warning these people to get the hell out of the way. And, of course, mostly they couldn't get out of the way. But it was true. When they finally hit a village, when that second wave came in, hell on earth was released. And time and time again, the women talk about that. They talk about these filthy slant eyes. They were like animals. They ran from door to door, raping. The raping, you know, perhaps a lot of your listeners think that rape is just vaginal rape or penis rape or penal rape, rather. Rape is a lot more than that. It's very terrible. I won't go into it right now.
It's the ultimate, you know, defilement. It's the final nail in the coffin of morality, really, and that's what it's about. It's about destroying the psyche of the people. They were hell-bent on doing everything they could to destroy the soul of the German people. And that's why I think they sanctioned this type of behavior and did it in this way. And these are unspeakable atrocities. And despite this, I've actually heard from people who are like, yeah, well, whatever, you know, kind of thing. They have an attitude of like, well, they kind of deserved it, you know, despite these being, women and children that weren't part of the war. They were living their lives. It doesn't matter whatever happened on the war front of things. These people had nothing to do with it, whether they were supporters of it or not. And even if they were, it does not justify what occurred to these people. You know, these are unspeakable atrocities. You know?
Yes, they are. And those individuals who say that they got what they deserved, I have this overwhelming urge to see it tried out on them.
Yeah, well, exactly. Jeez. Yeah.
When I talk about rape, this went on, sometimes it went on for weeks. It wasn't just an overnight thing. Indoors, outdoors, in parks, against walls, in ditches, in attics, in barns, the rapes went on. And the women, time and time again, and again, this is in the words of the folks themselves, the women, the children, from 8 to 80, that was the going rate of that a woman could expect to be raped, from 8 years old to 80, if you could imagine. Yeah. But it was time and time again. It wasn't as if one man rapes a woman, well, that's okay, we'll have to find another woman because this woman's been raped. No, one after another, sometimes 50 a night. And sometimes this went on for weeks. It depended on how long the front was static. In other words, if the Germans were holding out ahead, then this means the second wave was in that village for 2 or 3 weeks. And the rapes continued. There was no let up. Of course, many women died in the process of being raped so many times. They bled to death. It's ghoulish to talk about, but yeah, this is how sick and sadistic it was. Even death didn't stop the rapes. Lines would form behind dead women in the streets or in morgues even. A line of laughing Asiatics to rape a corpse, if you can imagine. And this is not some anomaly. This is not something that was rare. It's something that was pervasive. As hideous as that sounds, it is true. And when they were finally through, when rigor mortis set in and the woman was more like a dead tree, Then some filthy, depraved character would stick a tree branch or a bar, a steel bar, or even a telephone receiver in her vagina, signifying that she was closed for business. This rape, you know something, let me say this. Some people think I get off on this, and the blood and the violence and stuff. And Henrik, I don't know what to say. Maybe I do, because my books have dealt with a lot of war. Let me say this. People have accused me of being too graphic in this book.
Mm-hmm.
As you can tell, it is a very graphic book.
Sure.
It's in the words of the people themselves, though. It's not me actually describing it.
Well, exactly. Just tell us briefly about that before we carry on. Is it? I mean, just so people get an idea of what they can read more about in the book. I mean, these are, in some cases, it's writings from the people themselves. It's, you know, excerpts on what you've, things that you've, you know, dug up and get your hands on, basically, which talks directly about what they wrote themselves. How did you go about getting some of the material and references for this, Tom? Tell us about that quickly.
There were some really good books that no one has seen fit to use. There was one by a Catholic organization that went around asking women how they fared. I've also done quite a few interviews. And invariably, during the interviews, however, no woman would ever confess to being raped. Although I know they all were, but especially those in the East. But generally, I had to dig very hard, but I found a lot of good information. And when I say good, of course, I mean stuff that makes a book believable and readable. But let me say this. Do I have a few minutes here?
Oh, sure. Go ahead, Tom.
As far as the book being too graphic, even to a sickening degree, I, of course, realized this, but I'm not sure what to tell these people. These things were done to these victims. I'm not making this up. I'm not embellishing the accounts for some bloody sadistic pleasure. Let me say this. If I was tortured to death or raped by some inhuman monster, I would want everybody on Earth to know exactly how I was killed down to the last detail. To simply say that I was tortured to death or raped to death, that doesn't cut it. I want everybody to know what the amount of pain these monsters inflicted on me. It's not good enough to just say I was raped to death or tortured to death. And so for those who say that the book is too violent or too graphic, I say, well, read the book first. Then read it again and read every damn word. Read it and remember it. Then make sure you fight to prevent it from ever happening again to anyone.
Exactly. Well,
There would be no need for people like me to write about it if it never happens again. I promise you, I won't.
Yeah. Well, you know, guess what? This is war, and these are the testimonies of the people that we've never heard about. I mean, look at you can flick on any TV channel basically any channel you can imagine or any you know, movie or anything like that, and there's always only one side represented here, and it's always, you know, the allied version of things. And this is something that deserves to be mentioned and acknowledged, and it needs to be talked about and discussed, and consequently, so that we can get away from this idea, just as you kind of mentioned in the opening, that this somehow is the good war, right? It was the war that had to be fought, and it was like nothing we could do about it. We just had to do it. And of course, they've covered up an immense amount of atrocities to keep it and preserve it in this way. And that's what I'm most angry about, almost in all of this as well. That people are so that they've fallen for it. They've swallowed hook, line, and sinker the propaganda version of what this was about, even down to the idea that, you know, what the war was actually fought over. Even the ideologies themselves, the very concept of why this war was fought, is something that we don't even have any idea about today. We're so far removed from the reality of the situation that we're living in a fantasy bubble in regards to why and what happened during World War II.
Yes, propaganda allowed these crimes to happen, and then propaganda took over when the crimes were committed and basically projected the crimes back upon the vanquished. The victors just turned it around and blamed everything on those they had slaughtered and raped. Until this very day, you know, right now, you're extremely aware of this, but you've noticed that every time Israel is planning another slaughter fest somewhere in the Middle East, the most recent, of course, in Gaza, the Jewish media dutifully announces yet another death camp guard has been found or captured and being held for trial, and or survivors come, so-called survivors of the Jewish Holocaust, come forth with new tales and new things to whine and cry about. Have you ever noticed that this always seems to coincide when there's a terrible crime about to be committed by Israel somewhere? And, of course, that's the smoke. That's the smoke screen created by the propaganda from World War II. I'll tell you what, Henrik, the day may soon come when the roles are reversed and the outraged people of this earth who have suffered from Jewish hate and oppression go hunting down old Jews to bring to justice. For instance, there are thousands of Jews walking in Israel and the United States at this very moment who committed some of the most sickening and sadistic crimes imaginable. These occurred, of course, during the end of World War II, what we're talking about right now, when Jews tortured thousands of helpless men, women, and children, then buried them alive or drowned them in toilets filled with urine and excrement, and other horrors too sick to even talk about. I chronicle those in Hellstorm. And another fellow named John Sack, he, in a book called An Eye for an Eye, he also talks about this. He's a Jew, by the way. These people have been chasing the victims of World War II around ever since the war has ended. There may come a day, and it's coming pretty quick, I think, when these people who committed the most savage acts in world history may find someone else on their trail for a change, and putting them on trial.
Why do we never care about this? How has it been so? This is another question that I've been pondering upon as well, of how it's been so successful to keep this version, this particular narrative, going for such a long time. I mean, as we know, there's a lot of people questioning it. There's a lot of people that are, you know, getting trouble for just kind of looking at this from a historical point of view. It's largely intimidation, really, as well, in terms of what you're allowed to look at when it comes to history, which is just unbelievable in itself. But nonetheless, why have people swallowed this, do you think? What lies behind that? Is it just the traumatization of the event itself, where people go into a mode of basically being pacified, and they listen to authority, and they take whatever they hear, and then that becomes their truth? Or why have they allowed it, do you think?
Well, for the last 100 years, the sources of communication have been in the hands of Jews. In America, in Europe, especially America. America seems to, with Hollywood and its large conglomerate news agencies, seems to more or less control the thought process throughout Europe, America, Canada, Australia. And so for the last, in my opinion, the last 100 years, Jews have had a stranglehold on the sources of communication, whether it's radio, news, print newspaper, magazines, TV, and so on. And finally, we're starting to break that stranglehold, that grip on communication, on news sources with the Internet. Thank God for the Internet. People like you and your wonderful program are circumventing. We're going around this poisonous hold on the news. We don't have to rely upon Jewish news anymore. We're building our own news sources. And that's why I think that we have been so subservient for these last 50, 60 years. It's because there's been nowhere else to go for it. Now there's no excuse. If someone who doesn't understand what's going on right now, the truth, that is, if they still want to abide by the Jewish approach to the news and history, that's their business. But there's no excuse for now for not finding the truth. Everyone is just a finger tap away on the Internet of finding the truth. So there's no excuses anymore. And the fortunate good news is that many of us are circumventing that. We're finding, you know, it's like being freed. Probably 2 years ago, I wouldn't even be saying the things I'm saying now, but it's because of the Internet and people like yourself that I found out that there is another approach to this, the truth. In other words, the lies, I believe, are crashing down and crumbling down right now as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
This hold is, the grip is loosening. It's getting harder and harder to convince the mass out there that, for instance, World War II, the history is accurate. We know it's not. I think my book is just the beginning. In fact, I know it is. I know there's other people right now thinking about this. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Oh, certainly. No, you're absolutely right. This is what it's all about. It's about the control of information and, of course, keeping the, just a one-sided view all the time, basically, of what has been going on, and also, of course, kind of turning, victimhood on its head and using these aspects to gain, favor internationally and whatnot. And it's such an awful situation in that regard. And I think I wonder sometimes as well, is the spirit of truth strong? Is it going to last? Is it going to come out? Are we going to find out? There's certainly a lot of contradicting information out there. And of course you have to do the best you can to wade through that and analyze it and be, smart about it and piece the puzzle together in order to remove the contradictions that we find within it. But nonetheless, I wonder sometimes, is it going to occur for all the men and women that have died during these horrible wars and everything else? It's for them really that we need to do this. We need to set the record straight so that they will be, remembered and so that this crime will go. I don't know if we can, it's not about repairing it, but it's about basically acknowledging what happened for the sake of accuracy. And in that moment, I think we are going to be on better ground, don't you think?
Yes, I do. The greatest tragedy of World War II may not even have been the crimes committed against Germany. The tragedy may have been the conspiracy of silence that has shrouded World War II for now 70 years. I believe that's why history is so important. There's a saying in the English language, and I'm sure you have it in Swedish as well, that if you don't learn from your history, you're doomed to repeat the history.
Yeah.
That is, make the same dumb mistakes every time out. And, of course, we didn't learn from World War II. That's the reason we're talking right now. That's the reason I wrote the book, is because there is another side to this whole picture. World War II was so ugly and so evil that we should have never had another war after that, ever. The price of that horrible conflict was so great that had the people of the world known what really transpired, they would have insisted, in my opinion, with a single voice, they would have said, never again, never again. Not in our name, not in our time will this be committed, never again. But they did not learn what went on in World War II. The perpetrators, the victorious Allies and their Jewish handlers, they hid the crimes from the world with a blitz of books, TV programs, documentaries, movies, as you point out. And to this day, look around us. Look around ourselves. We have wars in the Middle East, nonstop wars being fought for the sake of Israel and Israel alone. Now, Israel has a proxy called United States. Let's just call him Uncle Stupid or Uncle Sucker. Every time Israel wants an enemy taken out, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Iraq, or hopefully not Iran, they want us to attack Iran. Well, they just point their pit bull, Uncle Stupid, in that direction, and Uncle Stupid dutifully goes to war with that nation and destroys it. That has got to stop. We didn't learn from World War II, and we're still committing the same mistakes. Remember Abu Ghraib? Do you remember the photographs that came out of that?
Oh, yeah.
That vile. The Americans mugging it up, these ignorant hillbillies, enjoying the sadistic satisfaction of torturing these people, naked, nude, on the ground, shocking them, stabbing them, humiliating them every chance they got. That's the face of war, my folks.
Yeah.
It's not the flag waving and the mission accomplished of George Bush. That is the face of war. We must stop that. We did not learn about World War II, and so we're repeating it all over again.
One thing I think is funny here too, it's like we hear the good guys won the war, right? And then yet at the same time, when we look around the world today, we are living, it's almost like sometimes it's like that timeline they showed in like Back to the Future, when they go on that alternate timeline and something that's wrong happens, and then like that's where we're in right now. It's something went awfully wrong, and we're living in this kind of Twilight Zone reality where we have a conception that the best outcome that could occur did occur, and of course the contradiction here is that if we look around today and see the world as it is, we can realize how many problems, how many wars, how much corruption, endless just barrage of idiocy that's out there. These are the fruits of of what I think occurred during the Second World War, because look at how much the world reformed after the Second World War. All political institutions, everything got homogenized around the world, down to, you know, languages, and it was all the different regions in the world kind of, they hardened in a different kind of way, and it become, in my view, in a way, a very different world after that war. And today we're living in, you know, in the aftermath of that. And that's what I think, that's what I hope people could kind of understand with everything that's happening today. It's bizarre, isn't it? It's a bizarre outcome.
It is. And we talk about the Allies winning the war, the victorious Allies. Well, that's quite a victory. I'd hate to have seen if they had lost the war. We have never been in control of our governments since that war. Not Europe, not America, not Canada, not Australia. And look at us. We're overwhelmed by illegal immigration, coloreds coming in by the thousands, by the millions, swamping our government, swamping our countries, creating third world environments in our nations that we've tried to keep clean and beautiful and prosperous and safe and happy. No. With a single voice, white Americans would say no more immigration. Let's kick out the ones that are here already. Let's get rid of them. And I think most Europeans would too, but we can't. We have been disarmed, especially America's influence on Europe. I hate that. America has become, I went from loving my country and, actually, At one time, I did love my country very much.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
During the Vietnam period, I was against communism. I was in favor of that war to stop communism. But after that, then I started becoming indifferent about my country, and now I actually despise it. I despise what it's done around the world. I despise the way it controls people. You know, we're Israel's pet poodle, America, but Europe's America's pet poodles.
Right.
Lots of pet poodles. And what we say, you do. And what Israel says, we do. And so I'm not blaming Israel so much as, or the Jews that run America or and Europe, so much as I blame ourselves. We can look in the mirror and see what the problem is. Not enough of us are standing up. You know, sometimes I get very hopeful. I get very depressed at sometimes, and sometimes I'm not. I'm happy. I think things are turning around. When I think that we don't need all the people on our side. We don't need all the Swedes, or we don't need all the Americans or French or Germans to suddenly wake up one morning and say, hey, I'm going to join you guys. We just need a strong central core of people like yourself that are fed up with this and are willing to actually walk that last mile, as you are doing. I hesitate to say it, but yes, we're actually willing probably to die for our beliefs now. When we turn that corner, we're going to be a very strong force to deal with. We're going to be very tough to defeat. We haven't turned that corner yet. We still are attached too much to our computers and our TVs and our vacations and our swimming pools. But that's coming to a close very quickly, especially here in America. We've passed from the first world to the second world. We've got people sleeping in the woods. We've got people unemployed. We've got immigration out of control, migrants, so-called migrants, just walking across the American border. Pretty quick, people are going to have to take a stand one way or the other. And
this is what I want people to understand in that equation as well, is that this is being done as a method to help to undermine and destroy the country. It's a way to not only, you know, dump the wages and getting people, you know, voting in a certain way and whatnot, all these things. But we have the quotes from the people who are talking about that the need to destroy, you know, European homogeneity, whatever that is in the world, you know, whatever, you know, pocket that happens to be in the world. It's an onslaught on that level. I mean, again, I refer back people to someone like Barbara Spector, for example, who talk about, you know, the involvement of her organization and her people in the destruction of Sweden, really. That's how I read that. I can't read it any other way. She's talking about bringing mass immigration into Sweden and that Europe has to change and it has to go in this direction for some reason. I mean, this is it's a crime, but people don't see it that way because it's still fairly... It's going quick, but it's still fairly in slow incremental steps, and people haven't kind of pieced that puzzle together yet that, oh, wait a minute. Oh, okay, so it's a warfare tactic. It's a continuation of the warfare against, you know, the European people. That's how I view it these days anyway.
We've stayed silent too long. People have not raised a voice when people like this creature specter you're talking about should get up and advocate basically our extermination. I'm not a violent person. I'm a vegetarian, as a matter of fact, and I've never been a fighter, so to speak. But I have this almost uncontrollable urge when I hear someone utter something like that to walk up and knock them down. When they advocate slaughtering me and my family and my race, I'm starting to get very unhappy and very angry at this. When enough people start getting angry, then we won't have the people like your specter basically advocating the death of Sweden, the death of Scandinavia, the death of Europe. Obviously, she's all for it, her and her Semitic brothers and sisters. We've got the same crowd of Jews in this country. They're against everything white and pro-minority up and down. They're they're pro-gun control, always pro-gun control. They're always pro-minority. They're always pro-illegal immigration. They're always pro-Middle Eastern war and American body bags. They're always anti-white, and they're always pro-colored. The day is coming, I'm sure, that, again, it's back to the control of the media. When people start getting most of their information from alternative media, radio stations like yours, websites like yours, then there's going to be something similar to these mass uprisings that we're seeing here in this country, blacks basically staging these riots. There was one in Florida, by the way, a black the media called it a flash mob. Have you heard of flash mob?
Oh, sure, definitely. Yeah, I've seen that. I wanted to ask you, please finish that thought there, but I wanted to ask as well, how do you think that they're seeking to use this? Because it's quite obvious that they've wanted to create these racial agitations and exacerbating this, of course, with more immigration as much as they can. How do you think that they are seeking to use this to create these kinds of conflicts between people? And in my view, it's always been done in such a way so that people are, again, obsessed about the ground level issues where this formulates itself, and at the same time we lose the perspective on who's at the top of that pyramid and to deal with the root of the problem, in my view anyway. But how do you see that they're seeking to use this?
Well, I think it's very clear, at least it is to me, that first and foremost they create confusion. When you have a mix of races being stirred in this pot, it's very difficult to get your feet on the ground and focus and say, what is the real problem? When you're worried about being beaten up on the way to the store, it's hard to think and imagine who's responsible for this problem right now of me being worried. You're worried more about being beaten up. That's the immediate concern. And so I think there is that element, and it's also the element of using the coloreds against the whites, basically as a hammer against an anvil. And, of course, there's always the miscegenation issue. Jews are always foremost in promoting race mixing among whites and browns and blacks. You can see it in American TV as far back as 20 and 30, 40 years even. This encouragement for whites and blacks to not just get along, not just accept each other, but get married, have children, have mulattoes, have different colored children. So eventually it'll be a coffee-colored population that Jews are dealing with, something much more manageable, something that will work and keep its mouth shut and produce and go to sleep, perhaps have children, take a vacation, but above all, not revolt against the power structure.
Is that the root of why they're doing this, do you think? I mean, we published that story a while back, and I think it was from Out of Natural Geographics, and of course they're over enthusiastic themselves about how quickly this is going to go, but they shot for, you know, was it 2040, how the average American will look and all that stuff, and it was like, that's just insanity of how quick they assume that this is going to happen. But it's almost like they're trying to, it's more a mental victory that they're trying to do and kind of enforce that if you like your Swedish heritage or your German heritage or your English heritage or what have you, then you're an evil Nazi, right? You're the epitome of a racist, and that's kind of the angle that they've tried to hammer this into people's consciousness at. And unfortunately, some people are actually falling for it, and they think that it's their duty to kind of end the Swedish line or the German line or the British line.
Yes, there's a good and bad to this. I believe that the more susceptible and gullible and naive and ignorant will absolutely fall for this persuasive approach to it. I agree totally that, yes, there is a, it may not be a concerted conspiracy, it's simply genetic. They understand what it takes to usurp and conquer a nation from within. They've done this for millennium. This isn't something new. They've done the very same thing throughout history. The good news is that there's a certain group of us that will never, ever swallow that one, ever. Our instincts are too sharp. Our intelligence is too great for us to actually accept what they're saying. We know exactly what they're doing. They may think that we don't, but we do. We're talking about it right now. There is another perhaps hidden value to this, and this is not the best, but I think there is something to it. We're basically winnowing out the weakest of the white population, the ones that are most susceptible to this race mixing. Perhaps it's better that we lose them. Perhaps it's better that they go away. That is, breed with other people, blacks and browns, and basically stop being white. Because right now we've got a certain group of people, white people, that are nothing but a drag to the rest of us. They refuse to lift their heads up above the grass like cows eating in the pasture. They refuse to do anything except watch sports and go shopping at Walmart. I've seen some of these people. I'm not afraid of losing them, quite honestly. I don't think we can ever save all of them, but that's just my thought.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, I think it's horrible. We put up an article the other day about how redheads, one of the most rare groups of people that we have, are you know, how their image have been, you know, viewed in the media and whatnot as well. But they're actually again, it's not going to happen as quickly as these scientists, quote unquote, I guess I should say, within the Natural Geographic's article, another one of these. But they talked about how they're becoming fewer and fewer and lesser and all that. And it's funny because it seems like it's such an immense double standard. In some cases, you have an incredible willpower to, let's say, preserve and protect certain things. There are people who are conservationists when it comes to certain things, but certainly not when it comes to, like, Swedes or Norwegians. I mean, we are a minority in the world, and that's, I've been trying to stress that. Sweden are probably just 8 million ethnic Swedes. We have 4 million Norwegians or whatnot. Sure, we're kind of similar, but it's still two distinct different peoples. And so they're called, you know, other people that come into our country minorities, but actually we are the minorities. That's what's so funny about this. And I guess I just want to add as well, I always have thought that there will be a spontaneous level to what we're talking about here, where there's truly people that they make a choice. They do fall in love, cross these boundaries of ethnicities and race and what have you. I think that's just the case, Tom. But at the same time, what we're talking about here is the concerted effort and the propaganda that lies behind the type of thing that we've been talking about, that there is a distinct interest to make sure that, you know, Europe no longer remains ethnically pure. I think it was even the NATO, former NATO general, I always forget his name, Wesley Clark, who even mentioned this, that there can be no such thing as a homogenous European population anymore. And, you know, Peter Sutherland in Ireland, there's been just a slew of all these people in high positions of politics and power talking about this like this is their greatest mission whatsoever. I mean, and how people cannot recognize this even from a conspiracy point of view when they're openly talking about what their plans are, but then when you mention it and bring it to people's attention, they criticize, you know, you for talking about it as opposed to the actual originator of this message. I think it's horrendous. And how is this not, you know, genocide? I mean, when Tibet was flooded with migrants, Chinese migrants, the whole world rose up. And yet it's not happening when it's occurring in Europe with these concerted efforts that we're talking about, you know?
Truly, we're an occupied people. I agree with what you say, that even if left alone to our own devices, yes, there would be some crossover, but when it's an orchestrated, intentional, deliberate attempt to phase out the white race by breeding with an almost inexhaustible supply of dark races, then it becomes very difficult, much more difficult. I use certain examples when I'm thinking to myself. I think about, you know, there is still a very solid core of Spaniards in Mexico, in this mestizo mulatto nation that we know as Mexico. There's still, all the leadership is still Spanish, Castilian. Just look at them. There's the, generally overall, they're all white Spaniards. They have avoided that. Now, of course, they haven't been bombarded like Europe and the United States with this need to.
Did you ever see Mexico's immigration law? I thought it was, I'm just bringing, please remember where you were. I want you to continue there, but let me just insert this real quick. I looked at the immigration law of Mexico. We published a story about that on redicecreations.com, and I saw that they actually had a law in there that if immigration into the country is starting to upset the ethnic status quo, or whatever you want to call it, the group itself, that they will begin to take active measures to throw out those immigrants. I was like, well, isn't that what America should have? It's just funny, you know?
Yeah. But you're right. And, of course, nothing could the thing we need, we need to, I mean, there's many things. If I had a wish list, I'd say, well, we'll stop right now. We're going to, there will never be another so-called migrant slipping into Europe through Italy. There will never be another so-called migrant crossing the United States borders. That's not going to happen. I'd like to say also that those who are in the United States, we cast them all out, including the people who have mixed their blood, mixed their race. They're out. But we're not. That's not going to happen. We're going to have to either carve off our own enclaves in Europe and United States, Canada, where we can be allowed to live our own lives. That sounds awfully terrible. You know, I'm not the first person to say this, but 100 years ago, we were ruling the earth. With the British Empire, French Empire, we were on top. Now we're on bottom. We have to turn this train wreck around. I'm laughing, but I'm really not laughing, Henrik. This is very important to me. If I knew what to do, I would do it. I would probably do it. I don't know what to do. Certainly talking about it helps. Programs like yours, raising awareness. Hey, we count too. We count as much as any ibex in the Alps, protecting ibex or protecting a fish in a river. We count too. We are, imagine the world without a white race. Imagine what it would look like today. All the creations, all the inventions, all the beauty, all the art, all the magic that we have created. And the Jews want us dead because we have been their greatest challenge ever since they started their program of basically dividing and conquering. We have always stood up to them. We have always been their challenge. I feel we will again in the future be their challenge. And I feel like we will win. Now, that doesn't mean I'm advocating gas chambers or ovens for Jews. That's a lie. And I'm telling you that it was a lie of World War II. But they must stop what they are doing. Will they do it? I don't think so. It's in their blood. It's in their genes to do what they're doing. But they must stop, or they will have to face the consequences.
All right, Tom, I want to hear more what you have to say. You're not mincing words here, and there's a lot more to get into here, of course. And we got into some of the more modern issues and problems here, and that's fine. It's what we're talking about here. But I want to return a little bit more later in the program here to Hellstorm and talk a little bit more about the book and some of the things you have been writing about. I think you have, 10 books in total or something like that? I just wanted to give out some of the details about that before we take a short break here between the segments, because there's so much more to discuss. But you've written on the Japanese wars, I believe, or their involvement in World War II. You've written about all kinds of different history. Tell us the titles you have out there and where people can go to pick up copies of these books, and of course also of Hellstorm.
Well, let me say this, Henrik, and I'll make it brief. If people want to check out Hellstorm, go to Amazon, Amazon.com, Amazon UK, Amazon Europe. The books and the e-books are for sale there, or they can drop, provided they're in America, they can drop $20 in my PayPal account, mtgoodrich@aol.com, and I'll send them a signed copy for $20. That's as cheap a book as they can find on Amazon. But I have a lot of books, and honestly, I think there's a dozen books, so to name them all, if they just go to look at Hellstorm, then they can see the books I've written about the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, Indian Wars. I wrote a true crime book, actually. Has nothing to do with politics. I've become a writer. That's all I do, I suppose, is write books. Probably a dozen books, Henrik. And I've got another one, the Japanese book I'm working on right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Haven't finished that, but it's a parallel story to what happened in Europe. In fact, I think we'll even title it Hellstorm, The Death of Imperial Japan, 1941 to 1947. Again, the powerful price of propaganda. Americans mowed down Japanese. When they tried to surrender, Americans would kill them. The propaganda was so terrible that it was a massacre. Everything was terrible. The firebombings of Japan, the nuclear weapons they dropped on Japan. The Japanese were not humans. They were animals. They were monkeys, according to the propaganda.
Jeez. Yeah, there's a huge, massive cover-up there, too, and I'm really glad you're talking about this topic. And so that we can learn that this is, again, it's across, you know, cultures. It's a war on certain aspects of humanity and certain traits within that. It's a very, I'll see if we can get deeper into that and what's at the root and the core of this. There's just so much to discuss here. But in the meantime, then we'll refer people further to Amazon.com, some of the other bookstores out there that hold your books. We're going to link up the email there as well for people in case they want to order directly from you via your PayPal account there as well. But yeah, stay with us, Tom. We'll take a short break and we'll pick this up right after the break. Right, ladies and gentlemen, we have much more to discuss with Tom Goodridge as we proceed with the second hour at RedEyesMembers.com. We're going to talk about the theft of German patents, machinery, scientists, and ingenuity that ultimately led to the space race between the U.S. and the Bolsheviks. We discuss the rise of internationalism, the World Bank, and ultimately the Zionist control of the political establishment and the media. We also go further into the question of why Europe is being completely overrun by immigration and what the elite's stake in this is regarding these genocidal activities. Why are they doing this? What is the desired outcome? And how do we respond to the targeting of the European people in this way? Later we go back, of course, talk more about the Second World War in our second hour. Keep in mind, we can't have an approach that goes allies good, Nazis evil. You have to have an approach which is, what is the truth in this situation and what are the lies? Or I think you're going to lose the plot. I hope you understand that aspect of it, especially if you appreciate the corruption that our world suffers from today, the aftermath, the consequences, and the purging of everyone. I would include those people in Russia, in Germany, even England and America and other European countries as well, that could have offered a resistance to the madness of the globalist establishment that we see controlling our world today. Upcoming on the program, we have Frank Salter, Kai Murrows, John DeNugent, Kevin McDonald, Dennis Fetcho, Michael Hoffman, John Rappaport, and Veronica Clark. Stay with us. We'll proceed at RedEyesMembers.com. Continue to listen. A candid and outspoken Tom Goodridge will be speaking more about his work in Hellstorm. Thank you for listening.